So she reminds me.
All right. Good evening. Hi, everybody. Welcome. Can you hear me? Hi, I'm Deborah Margolis, the Middle East Studies and Anthropology Librarian, and happy to see everyone here. You know, many familiar faces and new faces and students and faculty and community members. Great to see you. I'm going to thank the co-sponsors for this event first. So the MSU School of Journalism, the MSU Museum, the Office for Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives and Project 6050, the Department of Residence, Education, and Housing Services, the MSU Department of Religious Studies, the MSU Muslim Studies Program, the MSU Jewish Studies Program, Global Studies in the Arts and Humanities, and the MSU Peace and Justice Studies Program. So that's quite a list. And the person who brought all these groups together was not me, but Howard Bossen, and he's the one who organized Natan Devere's visit here to MSU this week. So I'm going to introduce Howard. And Howard will introduce Natan Devere, and Natan will speak, and we will have time for questions and answers afterwards. And we'll just ask that you come to one of the two microphones for your questions or comments so that everyone can hear. So Howard Bossen is a professor of photography and visual communication in the School of Journalism. He's adjunct curator of photography at the MSU Museum and core faculty in the MSU Peace and Justice Studies Program. He's currently teaching the journalism course called Witness, Photography, Film, and Social Justice. His latest book, which he co-edited with John Beck, is called Detroit Resurgent, which was published in April by the MSU Press. And he curated the exhibit now on view in Brody Hall, Natan Devere's 18. Please welcome Howard Bossen.
Good evening. I'm pleased to welcome you to tonight's lecture, Getting Closer, Understanding the Other, by Natan Devere. This lecture is a part of the MSU Library's fall colloquium series. Before I introduce Natan, I want to mention again his wonderful exhibition, 18, which explores the lives of 18-year-old Israeli Arab youth. It is on display in a new gallery space in Brody Hall and will be there through the end of December. So I very much urge you to get over there and see it. It's been quite interesting since the exhibition went up. There's been a lot of discussion by the students in Brody Hall. Natan and I have been over there a couple of times meeting with students, and the discussions that the work that surround the work with the students have been really, I think, invigorating and enlightening. Before becoming a photographer, Natan worked in the computer industry. He received an MBA from Tel Aviv University and an MFA in photography from the School of Visual Arts in New York. During the past 12 years, he has photographed for leading international news organizations, including the New York Times, the Times of London, Stern, The Economist, ABC News, and many others. He focuses on the human aspects of political, social, and cultural issues, and his personal projects include exploring the power of belief, African refugees in Israel, displaced people in Colombia, the Arab population of Israel, and the commercial urban landscape in New York. His work has been exhibited in solo and group exhibitions in the United States, Europe, South America, and Israel. The Museum of Fine Arts in Houston, the Portland Art Museum, the Santa Barbara Museum of Art, the Southeast Museum of Photography, Blue Sky Gallery in Portland, Oregon, the Schneider Gallery in Chicago, the Central European House of Photography in Bratislava, the Kultur Bahnhof Eller in Dusseldorf, the Tel Aviv Museum of Art, and the Museum on the Seam in Jerusalem are just some of the institutions that have exhibited his work. He's received numerous international awards, including Picture of the Year Award of Excellence and the International Photography Award, honorable mention for 2013, 2012, and 2011. And he's represented by Polaris Images Photo Agency and Anastasia Photo Gallery. He's also a faculty member at the International Center of Photography in New York City. And on Thursday, he's going to give a second lecture. He's presenting this year's School of Journalism Neil Shine Ethics Lecture from 3 to 4:30 in room 145 of the Communication Arts and Sciences building. Please help me in welcoming Natan Devere.
This works out? Yeah? Everybody can hear me? Yeah, it works a little bit. Well, thank you everybody for coming. I really appreciate that. Thank you, Howard, for a lengthy introduction. Kind of weird to think about things that you did and what you didn't do. As Howard mentioned, actually, I wasn't always a photographer. A couple of years ago, I was preparing for a trip to to Europe or something like that, and I opened up my passport folder just to find this very old business card. As Howard mentioned, my bachelor's degree is in computer science and economics, and then I got an MBA. And I had a long career in computers for many years, first in research and development, like this indicates, and the group manager, R&D department, then in marketing, and around 2002, 2003, I didn't like so much what I was doing anymore. I wasn't feeling fulfilled. And very luckily, I met a friend that offered me a beginning job as a small photographer in a new magazine that came to Tel Aviv, Time Out magazine. I'm sure some of you guys have came across during your travels, or in New York, or in other cities around the U.S. And I think that started more as a gig, just so I can have a little bit of a fun in my life and tell some friends that I took some nice pictures and hand them in a newspaper. Developed very fast to photographing for different magazines around Israel for commercial clients. This was my first cover, which I was so happy about. You know, suddenly I made the cover of a magazine about 3-4 months after I started photographing professionally, which afterwards followed with another series of covers. So the beginning was much more of an editorial photographer. Different things like the Dead Sea in Israel. And then a few months later, I went traveling to the Burning Man Festival in Nevada. I don't know how many people know the Burning Man. Some of you are already smiling, so you guys know what I'm talking about. Those of you that don't, this is why Google exists, Burning Man Festival. It's an amazing festival in Nevada, where 50 people come to the middle of the desert and build a city for a duration of a week, during which they build a new community and they express themselves in very dramatic ways. There's no jeans or shirts there. It's much more creative than that. 50,000 people, kind of like the student base here, right? So this is why I told Howard a couple of days ago that if MSU actually took place in Nevada, it would be the third largest city after Las Vegas and Reno. Thank you very much. So I photographed this for a couple of magazines in Israel, but coming back, I stopped in France at a festival called Visa pour l'Image, which is the largest photography festival for documentary and photojournalism. I went there, and then my eyes kind of opened of how big this world really is and how one can aspire. It really inspired me. I went back, had a talk with my boss, and switched careers. So that was 2003, so we're talking about 11 years ago. So the background was, again, as an editorial photographer or photojournalist. I started making my work, my way around the world of photojournalism in Israel. And living in Israel, one of the things that you actually come across quite a bit is conflict. So I tried to also find what I want to say as a photographer myself. I found myself covering some issues, but then I was also taking pictures for myself. And throughout this work about covering conflict, I found myself much more focusing not on the political side or necessarily the very informative aspect, but much more about how it affected people. What was the human aspect of that conflict? This is a kid coming back home on Friday, during East Jerusalem, through East Jerusalem, or a checkpoint also in East Jerusalem of people just wanting to go to work in this case. About 10 years ago, Israel built a separation barrier between Israel and the West Bank. There was a lot of terrorist attack coming from the West Bank, and eventually the most effective solution, as it actually manifested itself today, was to create a barrier, a wall. Some parts of it like this, about 25 feet tall, some of it more like a fence with sensors. But some people suddenly found a wall in the middle of their city or village separating them, so going to school sometimes was not possible anymore. There were alternatives to that, as you can see. this was also part, a village that was close to one part of the separation barrier, and the barrier just came through the fields. So while the wall was built, people were still trying to farm the land, creating these kinds of situations. And this was maybe the last picture that I added to this series, even though it was photographed much later during my career in 2007. Until 2007, the Fatah, a Palestinian organization, ruled Gaza. In 2006, the Hamas came to power through elections, and there was a fight in Gaza of the Hamas taking power. It was a week long of fights, very bloody fights, and as an Israeli journalist, I was there for a German magazine right there at the checkpoint. This is the beginning of the checkpoint, which is kind of like a terminal between Israel and Gaza Strip, called Erez Checkpoint. So we were there, you know, kind of monitoring the movement. There were not a lot of people coming in or out. Palestinians were going back home if they were in Israel. Foreigners were leaving Gaza because it was pretty dangerous being there. Suddenly there was a gunfight. The Hamas, there was about 60 people from the Fatah trying to take refuge in no man's land because it's kind of a border crossing. But a few days later, suddenly the Hamas comes, throws grenades and starts firing at them. So all of us journalists understand that, you know, fire is being fired. The smart thing to do is to lie on the ground, hopefully behind some cars or any kind of shelter. We're trying to take refuge, and suddenly this guy comes along, carrying one bag and this blue thing in his hand. So we're kind of asking him to take cover, and he ducks and says, like, I need to go home. So he was very troubled, so me and a couple of other guys had a talk with him. And he explained to us that he just has to go home, and he wouldn't listen to us, and he just walked into that center of the parking space, which obviously was cleared because nobody was there because of the fights. The guy there in the booth yells at him, you know, stop right now, we cannot handle you, just stop. So he just stands there like that. After a few minutes, and the fire kind of came down, and I go there and have a talk with him, it turns out that what he's holding in his hand is not a pizza or clothes or food. It's the body of his 3-month-old baby that passed away that morning in an Israeli hospital that tried to save him. So here I am, an Israeli journalist, covering a Palestinian conflict, standing with a man that just lost his son in the middle of a parking slot. And 40 feet away, there's a soldier that has no idea about that. So this is when you kind of flip and you stop being a photojournalist and you remember that you're first of all a human being. Me and another couple of photographers had a talk with that guy, brought the commander of the checkpoint in to escort the guy back home so he can bury his son. So this is the human aspect of conflict, and that kind of theme kind of followed with me throughout all of my career. I was, as Howard mentioned, I'm covering political, social, cultural issues, but always thinking about the human aspect of them. All the other stuff people can tell you on the news, I'm kind of trying to make you guys think in a different way. My biggest challenge when I wanted to be a photographer was to create something more meaningful, less the picture for the cover, which was a nice accomplishment. Okay, you can be a photographer. But the purpose was actually to create something much more meaningful in terms of it will make people think. It will, I don't know if it will change the world, but it will at least be the first step in some kind of change. And that would be not by creating one picture or another. Sometimes it is. You know, the girl running away from Naplan changed the world. The guy in Tiananmen also changed the world. I was looking more to do some photo essays, long-term photo essays that explored in a deeper level some social, cultural events. A photography essay, for example, as a research, but a photographic research. And eventually I was kind of looking for the first opportunity to really do that, something that will grab me. Because once you do that, guys, there's a lot of commitment involved. Mental, physical, time, financial commitment. If you have to be devoured mentally, you have to do the project, otherwise you will fail. And what happened was in 2004, Israel announced a disengagement plan. The disengagement plan was the initiation of Ariel Sharon, the Israeli prime minister at the time, wanted to take out 20 or to evacuate 21 settlements from Gaza Strip and 4 settlements from the West Bank. This is Gaza Strip. Oh, sorry. So at the south of Israel. This is Gaza, Deir al-Balah, and Khan Yunis, and Rafah are the main areas within that. Among them, there's 21 settlements. Now, just to understand the size of it, This is smaller than MSU. Within this, there's 2 million Palestinians and 8,000 Jews. That's more or less the balance. So, especially if you want to go to Netzarim, this settlement right here, you have to pass through here, go all the way here. You go only in an armored vehicle with a helmet and a vest. This is the way to go in or out. As a soldier, as a photographer, or as a person living there, or as a kid. That's the only way to get in and out. So when I heard about this, I was, you know, my first instinct was, I come from Tel Aviv, a very left-wing oriented city. I'm not a religious person. Most of the people there are. I have no idea why this guy would want to live there. And what happens when I don't understand something? I take my camera and I go. So I asked a friend of mine who was a photographer for Haaretz newspaper, kind of like the New York Times of Israel, if she minds showing me around. We grabbed the car, we drove around, and for a day we spent in Gush Katif. This is how it's called, the Katif lump, in a way, which kind of felt like this at some points. So we went around there, mostly around all these settlements around here, and eventually at the end of the day we got to this place called Shirat Hayam. Now, Shirat Hayam means Song of the Sea in Hebrew. It's a chapter from the Bible. It was a settlement of 16 families on a beautiful, beautiful beach that used to be a resort for the Egyptian army before Israel conquered this territory in 1967. These destroyed houses that you see here used to be the villas or the resort itself and were left there untaken. About 50 yards in front, just in front of this, somewhere around here, you have a line of caravans where those people live. Young families with young kids, some of them just like getting to, all of them religious, not ultra-Orthodox, but conservative. 50 yards in front of that, there's a beautiful beach. 30 yards behind, there's a concrete wall and a fence. And behind that, Palestinian territory. So this guy already is a Palestinian. That's the difference between your enemies. This is the conflict zone. So, during my first trip, I photographed this picture, which kind of was weird as a stable, or this picture. This is kind of how you have to go to the beach, in case something happens. The place kind of resonated with me in a weird way. I didn't understand why, but it kind of stayed with me. And during the next few months, I continued coming back and forth to Gush Katif. Every couple of weeks, I would take my car, leave my work, and just go there for a day shooting, kind of doing research, trying to really understand what was happening there and why was it happening. It started making sense until in October, in May 2005, I decided that the way I'm going to do a project about the disengagement would be to photograph the people of Shirat Hayam. And, you know, there was different ways of doing that. I could photograph the news events. I could photograph one person. I could photograph a collection of people from all across the area. I decided to photograph that settlement. That was, for me, the place I wanted to be. Their story would be the story I want to cover, and that was the challenge. Now, you have to understand that I'm dealing with, let's put this one. These are the caravans that we're talking about. These are the houses the people were living in. So I'm dealing here with 16 families, religious people, very much opposing the disengagement in one of the hardest periods of their life. And on top of that, they hate photographers. Because every time that they leave their house, there's 5 cameras of Associated Press, Reuters, EPA, AFP, Getty, aimed at them, because all the world is talking about them. Everybody wants pictures. And even if it's a picture of me dragging my son to school, that's a great picture. And the place was picturesque, so I'll give you that. So here, I want to get into their lives, right? Three months from now, they're going to be gone. What do you do? Tricky situation. Now, there's different ways of getting in or being able to do a story, none of which was really available at this, given the time frame and also the way that the place was built and how the interaction between the people. So I had to be a little bit creative. Now, Israel is a little bit of a bipolar society. We have Memorial Day and Independence Day one day after the other. And the Jewish day ends or starts in the evening. Like right now, it's already Thursday for the Jews. So you basically move from extreme grief at 4 o'clock to extreme joy at 6 o'clock. It's like the craziest national mental breakdown that you could ever imagine. But it's also two very, very important days because Memorial Day means a lot in Israel. There's a lot of, like, almost every family either has somebody that they lost or knows somebody that they lost. And Independence Day, since a very young country, means also a lot. And other than that, we can celebrate and eat a lot of great food. So barbecues goes a long way. Anyway, that was very much in the week that I decided to do this project. So I decided to use those 2 days and photograph for the best of my ability. Let's go back a little bit. So this is the synagogue. They were preparing Independence Day. I also knew that during those days they would accept photographers much more because they're celebrating. So preparing for Memorial Day. This was the Memorial Day ceremony in the evening. That's already Independence Day in the morning. Those are the caravans, again, in the back, on the beach. So, or soldiers taking a break, you know, playing some backgammon. There's always soldiers, by the way, guarding the settlement. They're 24 hours a day, because without that, who knows who's going to go in. So I photographed that, went back home, chose 20 pictures that I liked best, printed them 5x7 in 20 copies, and bound them into 20 booklets titled Memorial Day, Independence Day, Shirat Hayam 2005. And I knocked on the doors, saying, "Hi, I'm Nathan, I'm a photographer, this is a present." And when somebody offers you a present, you know, the courteous thing is at least saying, you know, "What's your name? Would you like a glass of water?" So I literally used that to have my foot in the door and come in and start a conversation with those families, explaining to them, "Hi, I'm Nathan, I'm a photographer. Yes, I know you hate photographers. I'm a little bit different. I don't want to report about you. I actually want to understand you guys. I'm going to be around here. If you guys want to take part in the project, I'd love that and appreciate that. If you don't, I will respect that. If there's something you don't want to photograph, I'll respect that as well. And we'll see how it goes." Now, if you notice, what was the word that I used a lot here? Respect. Bingo. Angus kid in the house listened properly. Respect. When you do a work like this about people that you don't know and try to actually portray their lives, the only way you're going to succeed in a lot of levels is if you have respect. Regardless of if you understand or if you're interested, you have to respect. Because they will really appreciate that respect and it will create a mutual engagement between you and your crowd. Not only that, if you respect them, you're respecting your audience. If you're disrespecting them, you're disrespecting your audience. If you're looking at a picture of somebody, you know, somebody holding a head of, you know, beheaded head, let's take ISIS for example, do you respect the photographer for photographing that? No. Because you don't understand that he didn't respect you or the subject that he photographed. So that triangle between photographer, subject, and viewer kind of works in multiple ways. If the photographer doesn't respect the subject, the viewer doesn't respect the photographer. So respect. This is how I started. Tried to photograph, you know, all peoples involved, the Arab people, for example, the villagers that were around here. They were not friendly, but they were also not violent. They kind of understood that things are changing and nobody wanted to create a problem. Some pictures are sometimes metaphors for how deep we are in the situation. And slowly I started making friends. You know, it's a hot place, so every once in a while, knocking on the doors, "Can I get some water? Would you mind if I use your restroom?" So people start offering, inviting me, and also kind of really trying to understand, who's this guy? You know, and I was really interested, which is another thing that is very critical when doing work like that. If you're not really interested in what you're doing, if you're there just so you can show some good pictures to somebody, it doesn't work. You have to be genuinely interested in the people that you're photographing. Ask the question, listen to what they have to say. And they notice that. So suddenly, I was kind of this weird, tall guy from Tel Aviv that actually is interested in what we're saying. So this is lunch, for example. I became really a part of the settlement to the level that, you know, one of the things they asked me to do is to do Shabbat. You know, for those of you that are not Jews, this is Shabbos. It's a very holy day. It's the holiest day for us on a weekly basis, let's say, a holy day. The holiest day was the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. I'm not a holy, religious person. I've never done Shabbat in my life. One of the things that you do in Shabbat is you put your camera down. No photography. Why? God didn't create anything on that day. Neither do we. There's no turning on the light. There's no turning on the oven. There's no turning on anything. You're just with your family, with your community. And I did that. Why? Because I was interested. And one of the things I really wanted to understand how these people are living. And once I did that, two things happened. Once, I really understood. The second thing was they were like, all right, you're one of us now. If you really did that, you are like no other person we ever brought inside. So instead of, you know, thinking of is he going to get into their house or not, they were fighting who's going to invite me to the meals. There's three important meals. So who's, because for them it's a mitzvah. It's an important thing that this is how you give back. And trying to explain to me about Judaism and about Shabbat. Fascinating. This was already towards the evacuation. One day before the evacuation, a separation ceremony from the sea. The three women that I was with, the main family I was staying with, were saying goodbye, took a vow never to go to the sea again because they were living there for a year, and since then have never gone back. Same family that night, the Picard family, it's a French family. As you can see, this is one of the destroyed houses. This is the separation barrier behind them, and I'm having my back to their house. This is the proximity. And then the evacuation came, 18th of August, 2005. It's weird. My voice is still trembling when I hear about that. Very hard day for everybody. Everything went up very peacefully. It was thought to be one of the more militant settlements in Gaza, but they decided as a decision of all the whole the settlement not to raise their hand on any soldier because they're Jewish as well. So everything went out very peacefully, but very emotionally. This is how you can imagine. This is how it was like coming around. And eventually coming inside the houses. This is the Picard family, the people that were separating from the sea. Now, in this situation, the soldiers come in and kind of explain that, guys, you have to leave your house. No packing, no nothing. Now, you have to leave your house. And trying to do that respectfully, understanding the sensitivity in this case. So they ask for the Last Supper while the soldiers are standing there, looking at them while they're doing their last prayers and having the last meal. And at this point, everybody in the house is crying. Everybody. Family, the soldiers, and yours truly. The only shield I have is my camera. Continue shooting. Kind of an obligation to the people I just spent 3 months with. 3 days later, coming back for the last time. I'm still in touch with these people. They're still my friends to a certain extent. You know, we're kind of on different continents, but they still update me when somebody's getting married or somebody's born. People from the total opposite side became friends. A lot of people there, I mentioned, were religious, and there were a lot of religious experiences during this time. And after spending a few more months, you know, looking at my archive, I found a lot of imagery that was taken very dramatic, either religious or political events, including the disengagement period. And I decided to really try to kind of explore why am I photographing that. And as part as an artist, sometimes the process is reverse. I kind of like to trust my subconscious, understanding that I photograph things because I'm interested in them in a way that I don't understand until the pictures exist. And then trying to look at them, think about them, and try to work on it on a more conscious level. This is what happened with belief. This is a picture that was taken about half a year after Shirat Hayam at the West Bank settlement called Amona. While the evacuations for the settlements went pretty peacefully, the settlers, which are violent people on a regular basis, were kind of uncomfortable that they were evacuated so easily. So 6 months later, when Israel Supreme Court ordered the destruction of 9 illegal buildings in a West Bank settlement called Amona, when the military came to destroy those buildings, they were opposed by 4,000 young Jewish settlers, more or less around your age. These guys. This is the scene when the military goes into the settlement. Any idea why those guys are smiling? They are doing a righteous thing to their opinion. They're being the soldiers of God. They're defending the state, the soul of Israel against its oppressors, even if the oppressors are Israeli soldiers. It was a day of battle. 2 people injured on both sides before those buildings were destroyed. But on the other hand, I also had imagery like this. This is Easter in the Holy Sepulchre Church. Thousands and thousands of pilgrims coming to Jerusalem to pay, you know, to take part in the processions along Jesus' last path, ending up in the Holy Sepulchre Church, where this is the stone where it's believed that Jesus was taken down from the cross and being buried. So I had those two axes, those two extremes. On one hand, religion giving a lot of, or belief, giving a lot of amazing values as community, belonging, understanding of our place in this world, our main questions in life, a place to go to when things get hard. But on the other hand, sometimes it pushes people to extreme situations or things that they would not otherwise do. And even we're living in a 21st century where, you know, we have mobile technology, social media. Identities are really defined in a very, very different way. But even in this very modern times, belief is maybe the strongest power that motivates people. This country is no different than that. So I decided to explore this this spectrum by those two axes. And in what I do in most of my projects, I try not to make you guys, not to tell you guys what to think or my viewers what to think. The same as in Shirat Hayam. I was a left wing, I was photographing right wing. When this was exhibited, people were kind of trying to guess what my political opinion was because they couldn't really understand. And this is what I love, because if, let's say I'm telling you what to think, I have an opinion, a very specific opinion. If you're part of, if you already believe in that, then you're applauding and everything, great exhibition, great, right? Did anything change? No, you have the same opinions. If you are of the opposite camp, you look at this, you dismiss it immediately, this is horrible, the guy doesn't understand anything, you know, did he change anything? Nothing changed. So eventually you're talking to a very small group right there in the middle that haven't made up their mind yet. Instead, I trust you guys to actually have a background of yourself and be intelligent people. Have a different background than myself, you know, have a different reading on reality. Try to create a platform that will allow you guys to think or will kind of make you think. The kind of conclusion that you want to get to, it's your own responsibility. I don't know if my conclusions are right. It's just, for me, they're right. So, also in this case, you know, I have an ambivalent place of thinking about belief, and this is what I try to create here, by showing a lot of things that people don't otherwise come across. Also Easter, the same day, people at the end of their journey, a little bit tired, not really noticing where they're resting. Or this is 4 years before, Ramadan prayers outside the walls of Jerusalem. Sometimes the holy mosque, Al-Aqsa, inside Jerusalem, on Ramadan, especially on Friday prayer, you want to go to the mosque. But unfortunately, sometimes it's a little bit more sensitive politically, and there's a big chance that there will be riots after the prayers, and therefore the Israeli authorities block the entrance to the old city of Jerusalem for anybody under the age of 45. What do? You pray as close as you can to the mosque. In this case, the entrance to the old city, which is also a market, because it's the entrance to the old city, therefore the garbage. Nice story about this one, by the way. Last year, I exhibited this work in Cleveland, and I had this really nice event, you know, with a group of collectors, which is kind of the dream of a photographer, you know, to sit with collectors, hopefully offering their prints, making some money. It helps pay, you know, makes life a little bit more comfortable. It was a great event, and I was really happy. And while I'm wrapping up my prints, because everybody already left, suddenly there's a guy coming in, and he asks, are you the photographer? And I'm like, yes. So, who are you? So I think his name was Jorge, but I might be mistaken. And he explains to me that he's the janitor, and he's been cleaning the space every day for the last couple of months. So he's been looking at the work while he's cleaning the space, and he has a couple of questions, if I have some time for him, even though he's the janitor. And I'm like, oh my God, I think I have as much time as you want. We spent about half an hour going one over and explaining to him what is happening and why it was photographed. So eventually I asked him, so Jorge, which is your favorite picture? And he points to this one, which is a pretty unusual selection given the other ones. I'm like, so Jorge, why is this one your favorite picture? He says, well, look at the belief of those people. They, you know, they have a connection to God that they pray next to the garbage. They understand that this is part of life. It's nothing bad. It's just where they are. Interesting perspective from a guy. For me, it was always about oppression, about disrespect of the authorities to the Palestinians. A janitor taught me something about my photography 10 years after the picture was made. I kind of love that kind of moments. This is Purim, the Israeli Halloween kind of family. The kids get dressed up in all kinds of costumes, a little bit of different themes than the American Halloween, I can assure you that. We like queens and kings from the Bibles, or soldiers and policemen, or guys from Turkey in this case. The older men have to get drunk. Pissed drunk. The order actually is that they have to get drunk to a level that they cannot remember their own name. Now, unfortunately, I'm guessing that some of you guys have gotten drunk in your life. It's a pretty embarrassing thing to do, first of all. And second of all, you might hurt yourself or other people. So since they want to do it responsibly, because it's a thing of all the community gets drunk on one night, they get into a synagogue or a huge space, pray together, and get drunk together. So by the end of the night, it kind of looks like a rave of Orthodox people, you know, lying around. Can you imagine that one? I would not, like, you're not allowed to shoot, and you kind of don't want to shoot because it's extremely disrespectful. But they allowed me in to this part. Muslim prayer is one of the hardest prayers to photograph. I was photographing this actually when I was doing the 18 project, which we're going to talk about later. When I was photographing this, I was waiting for a person that I wanted to photograph. And suddenly I hear the shout of the muazzin, the person in the mosque calling everybody for the prayer on Friday. So I asked my interpreter, let's go there. And he's like, you're in the most militant Muslim city in Israel. Are you nuts? I'm like, yes, I'm nuts. Let's go there. So we go there, and I ask for permission to go into the mosque and photograph. And surprisingly, the people are so shocked that the Jewish person would want to do that. So they're like, okay, you're welcome in. Etfaddal. But just remember one thing. You're not occupied. This is not occupation here. You know, you step in, you're Jewish, you have to respect us. This is a holy place for us. Otherwise, you're out. So I walk in. And again, back to Muslim prayer being hard to photograph. If you're in front of the Muslim people praying, it's super disrespectful because they're praying to you. The direction is critical. You're praying towards Mecca. If you're photographing from behind, you're even more disrespectful because you're photographing their behinds. And I want you, unless you want to make a very distasteful joke, you're really, you know, hurting yourself and everybody else. From the side, unfortunately, it usually doesn't really make a good picture, just visually. So here I am, after years of frustration of not really feeling like I ever captured an amazing picture of a Muslim prayer. I woke up just so I don't disturb the people. And here I am. And literally I'm thinking, oh my God. So I photographed this, and then I sent each and every person I photographed in the other project a group of pictures, including this one. 6 months later, four months later, I come to revisit her and re-photograph. Then there's a few people out there in the street saying, you're the guy that photographed the picture of the mosque. And I'm like, what? Which picture of the mosque? And it turns out the girl loved the picture so much that she spread it around her friends, which spread it around, and suddenly it was viral all across the city, and it became the official picture of the mosque. And they were kind of, everybody wanted to ask me, how the hell a Jewish person understood Islam to photograph this way? One of the biggest compliments one can get when photographing the other. This is a group of evangelic priests being baptized in the baptism ceremony in the Jordan River. If you guys have been baptized, usually it's not a group thing, right? It's one by one. But all of them are priests. They just finished baptizing a group of 600 people. At the end, they want to be baptized themselves, but they have to perform the baptism themselves. So they form this circular formation where everybody goes, they say the prayers together, and then everybody goes in and out. So you're both performing and being performed on the ceremony at the same time. I try to look at different parts. Like, Israel is a really interesting place in terms of politics and religion. This is not necessarily about religion. It's about belief. It's not titled faith. It's titled belief. It can be a walk of life, gender, anything that you want. The same thing come across, but I use specifically religious and political belief. These are Samaritans. There's an 800 Samaritan left in the world in two congregations. One which is called Holon next to Tel Aviv, and the other one in the West Bank, next to Mount Gerizim. This is where it is. This is the holiest place for the Samaritans during a pilgrimage ceremony. This is in the middle of the night. It's like a 10 seconds exposure. As you can see, those guys are not moving much. They're sweating until the morning, and this is how the morning looks like. They actually believe that they are the true Jews. They are performing the ceremonies or the pilgrimage exactly like in the times of the Bible, including slaughtering sheep, cooking them inside the ground, eating the sacrifice until the morning, everything to the letter. And including this, they have their own kind of Bible or a version, a holy book. It's only four families, 800 people, marrying amongst themselves, which obviously creates some kind of problems biologically. So I try to look both at the general public and also individual within this public. The state of mind, sometimes aggressive, sometimes spaced out like this woman that was just baptized by one of those priests. As you can imagine, I'm like very close here, about like 2-3 feet away from her, photographing this, trying to both understand and be respectful. And I was really thinking that she totally, you know, she was in a place of her own. I walk around, and then a few minutes later, she taps me on the shoulder and she says, "You really understood where I was, right?" And she leaves. Now, each product has its own visual language, just because in order to communicate better the ideas, one has to have a language that will support that. We're talking here about belief, and especially a lot of religion, so the history of art, especially religious art, definitely takes a role here. And light, color, and composition are some of the main tools here. This is a pilgrimage for a yearly pilgrimage to a place called Mount Meron. Half a million ultra-Orthodox people from all around the world gather, and they celebrate during the nights, and in the morning there's a huge prayer. Now, for the younger ladies, it's considered to be very important to pray there very passionately, because you have a better chance of finding a good husband and having a lot of children, which is very important in Judaism. For a man to get into these parts, and again, photograph, you have to apply a lot of sensitivity. In Judaism, you can actually photograph in front of a person, but you cannot do in Islam. Or at least you don't want to do if you are respectful. This is Hebron, a city of 400 Jews living among 45,000 Palestinians. Pretty crazy situation. Whenever the Jewish people, really extreme, radical Jewish settlers, right wing, so they're kind of looking for violence and confrontation all the time. Whenever they're walking through the center of the city, they have to be escorted by the military, just so they won't be killed. And in a way, sometimes also so they won't try to create all kinds of altercation with the Palestinians. This is Kaparot. It happened a couple of weeks ago, well, 3 weeks ago. On the Day of Atonement, us Jews believe that your name is written in the book of life or death, you know, one or the other. In order to get your name written in the book of life, you have to repent all your sins. So what we do, we ask for forgiveness from everybody that we might have offended during the year or created something sinful towards. But at the end, we're still not sure that we really covered our, you know, all bases. So what we do, we take a chicken, a rooster for a man, a hand for a woman, swirl it over our heads 3 times, say a certain prayer, and believe that all the remaining sins are transcended into the chicken, which is then slaughtered. She's dead instead of you. Sounds logical, right? For some people, it does. This is not an order from the Bible. This is a ceremony that was developed across the years and is very highly criticized, even within the Orthodox sects. There's a way of actually, the chicken are used for the Last Supper before the fast. Everybody's fasting on that day, or donated to the poor for that specific supper. An alternative is just to donate money, so those people can buy, you know, the food that they need. A lot of people are going to that. Needless to say, animal rights organizations are furious about this. It is not powerful enough. Like Judaism, animal rights association. Yeah. You know, one would win. Question, guys. Is she Muslim, Christian, or Jewish? Hard to tell, huh? This is why I like this picture. You know, there's definitely differences between the religions, but there's so much similarities as well. She's Christian. She's in the Holy Sepulchre Church. This is part of the tomb of Jesus. There's a hatch. It's a specific day, which is called the Holy Fire ceremony, the Holy Fire Saturday. There's about 20,000 pilgrims inside the Holy Sepulchre Church, and at 2 o'clock they open a hatch. That light hits the tomb of Jesus. There's the patriarch goes inside, lights a group of candles from inside, and passes it to 7 different messengers that run around for 7 different Christian sects. And the light is passed from one to the other. Within 2 minutes, you have 20,000 people holding candle lights inside a closed church. As you can imagine, the quantity of fire versus people in a closed place is not really a smart thing to do. So after a few more minutes, they have to take it down. But then there's a lot of ceremonies, including this. Now, these pictures were photographed. I was waiting since 7 a.m. in a place on the second floor. If you've ever been to the Holy Sepulchre Church, it's around, the main area is really round. I was there with my widest lens waiting for a perfect picture that I would take of everything circular. And then 15 minutes before the ceremony, another photographer tests out something with my camera and not distressed, but I cannot use that wide lens anymore and my main camera body, which I want to kill that guy. Or at least torture for a while. Anyway, here I am. I'm sitting there for 7 hours and now no picture. By definition, I cannot take the picture. So after frustration, I said, okay, I have another body of another lens. Let's see what I can do. And this happens. So when things don't go your way, plan B is sometimes plan the thing that should have happened. This is one of the first pictures in the series. It's during that pilgrimage that we saw the younger women praying. This is a group of ultra-Orthodox men. In the night, there's huge fires. And so they're just watching a fire and there for the smoke. I'm not a religious person, but sometimes the gods of photography are very nice to me. So this is the entrance for the to the Holy Sepulchre Church. And I was standing there kind of waiting for something to happen. Suddenly everybody clears out and there's this pilgrim and this soldier totally unaware of their mutual existence. So I wait there 30 seconds, you know, kind of appreciating the moment. And then I pick up my camera and I snap a couple of pictures. This is the sharp one. The second one is already, she's moving. While the women were praying passionately, this is the guys praying 4 years later in the same area. And this was part of Shirat Hayam. This was on the beach. Women have to pray once as opposed to the men that have to, Jewish women have to pray only once as opposed to the Jewish men that have to pray across the day. And they can choose the time, which prayer of the day they can pray, and they can choose wherever they want to pray. The men have to be at least 10 men to pray together, a minyan. So this, there was a group of 300 people that came to support the settlers, and they lived in huts for about a month and a half before the evacuation. And this is that. This one of the last pictures I took during the evacuation. It's a Jewish settler standing after morning prayer next to his house waiting for the army to evacuate him. The flames coming from a burning roadblock that was placed, you know, in front of his, just on the road, kind of a metaphor for this whole situation, at least in my eyes. I'm going to skip on a couple of projects here. If we're going to have time at the end, I might go back to them. One is about African refugees in Israel, and the other one is about displaced people in Colombia. You have them both on my website. You know, if you guys want to have a look, drop me an email. By all means, do. I'll try to answer a little bit intelligently. But this is kind of the reason why we're here. In 2008, I moved to Israel, but in 2009, I decided to do a project that I kind of thought about for a while, and finally I got the financial means to do it, the supporting. Israel is considered as the land of the Jews, right? Kind of, at least how it's reported. The actual fact is that Israel is not only Jewish. 80% or close to 78% are Jewish, but 20-something percent are not. They are descendants of people that used to live in Israel before Israel was established. Mostly Arab, Muslim, Christians, Druze, Bedouins, which are also Muslim, but specific sect of the Muslims. A huge, huge minority that kind of everybody forgot about. Because everybody's talking about the Jewish people in Israel and the Palestinians in the West Bank. If you guys listened to the news a few months ago, nobody talked about this minority that is kind of torn between because they are coming from Palestinian origins, but they hold Israeli citizenship. So where do they stand? And I decided to do a project about these people because I thought, you know, maybe there's something here. Maybe there's an option to change something. And so now I thought about how do I actually make something effective about the Arab-Israeli population. And I decided to focus on people that were 18 years old because I wanted a project that would be forward-looking, of thinking and not photographing people that have been there for 50, 60 years and already have a very set opinion, which can definitely not be changed, and talking about the past. I want to talk about people, some of them, again, your age, that would are not sure about their future, have more questions than answers, but have a strong background, and also are willing to take some risks that their parents would not take anymore. So that was interesting. And the issue of 18 is also because 18 is a very special age in Israel. 18 is when you finish your high school, you graduate from high school, you're acknowledged as an adult into society, you're being given the right to vote for the parliament, but while the majority of the Jewish people go to the military, the majority of the Arab people don't. Except for the Druze. The Druze go to the military. Otherwise, you don't. So it's basically the separation point between the two societies. Before that, everybody's a kid. Suddenly it's like you're Jewish or Arab. Now, when I first started, again, my background was from editorial photography, photojournalism. You saw some of the pictures I'd taken. I can create some drama in my pictures, right? So I wanted to think about, you know, how can I do something valuable, something different? And I tried to think about, you know, if I tell you Arab-Israeli kid, what kind of imagery comes to mind? What would you expect? Sorry?
Throwing stones.
Kafiyas, maybe a camel. If you really don't know Israel and you think you're living 300 years ago, you'd be surprised. A lot of camels came up in those answers. You know, so at least something valid, right? Well, let me help you. I did a search this morning. Arab-Israeli kid on Google. This is the imagery that comes up. Okay, so if you're an Arab person in Israel, you're probably holding a gun, or are injured, carried by the military or police, have a sheep, being shot, playing like you're being shot at by Jews, carrying explosives in a training. This is your kindergarten, right? This is the imagery. This is the top hits on Google. Any idea why we have these as top hits on Google? Kind of depressing, right? Sorry for ringing your mic. Yeah. So this is mostly what is reported by. This is the media way of covering Arab-Israeli Jews. Arab-Israeli kids. This is how they're reported about. Why is this the image that we have while reporting on the issue? Because I'm sure that as intelligent people, you know, you kind of can imagine that this is not necessarily all of the reality. This is not the only storyline. Why is this what you normally see? Any ideas? Sorry? Everybody? Okay. I'll show you something different in a few minutes. But even let's say that this is true. All right? Let's say that those reporters followed on this. And this is actually the truth. Is this helpful? Is this kind of imagery helps create any kind of change? It might be helpful, let's say that this is happening and this is the only truth. So one can say, like, somebody needs to bring the truth up, we need to know. And with that, I totally agree. All right? But there's a question of, okay, now that we know, how is this helpful? Now, just to answer my question before about why we have this imagery, it's kind of related to how the media works. And being part of the media, I kind of did the same thing myself. The media works by using stereotypes or common storylines. You have to be, you're giving a story which normally has a limited, you know, you have a limited attention span and there's a limited space in the magazine or anywhere else. It's not necessarily a very deep research. So the way to communicate things fast is by using stereotypes, unfortunately. And this is done as much as possible. If you have a storyline that you don't have any stereotypes, it's much harder to understand. Do you guys understand Ebola? No, right? Or most of you, I don't understand it. And I try to think about it and read as much as I can, but it's still super confusing, and I don't know what's going to happen, right? The only thing that I can tell you is about that there's a few thousands of meaningless Africans that died, right? Why? Because that's the story that we know. Africans don't matter. And I'm sorry for being very harsh here, not politically correct, but I'm trying to make a point. So no disrespect to anybody, please. That's the thing. This is why this imagery is kind of happening. And one might say even this is what everybody experiences on a normal day. Okay? And I don't want to totally argue with that, but my personal experience was that it's a little bit different, at least what I saw. What is more important for me was, let's say that this is true and this is the reality. If we're using this kind of imagery on a normal basis, we're not allowing any room for change. Because what we're feeding ourselves is the same narrative over and over again. And even if, let's say that the Jewish people of Israel are totally disjust. They're doing a state of apartheid against the Palestinians, and they're horrible. All right? Okay. How am I using this imagery to change that? I can't. So I decided to abandon everything that I was taught to do, because this is the kind of imagery I was taught to do as a photojournalist, and try to create something different, something that will at least allow a beginning of a discussion. So when I photographed those 18 years old, I decided to photograph them differently. I didn't want to photograph the demonstrations. I didn't want to photograph the poverty. I didn't want to photograph the political conflict. I didn't even want to talk politics. I wanted to talk about Muhammad from Nazareth, or about Dina from Jaffa, or about Bara from Arabe, and Ihab from Bilayn, or Asil from Umm al-Fahim. I photographed 64 people. Each person I photographed, I first interviewed about their life. You know, what's their background, their family, their village. What do they like to do? What do they hate in school? What do they like in school? What are their hopes? What are their dreams? What are their obstacles? Where do they see themselves in 5 years or 10 years? How do they identify themselves? How do they define themselves? And after that, I asked to photograph their portrait. And when photographing somebody's portrait like this, it was very important for me to actually incorporate them in the process of photography, because I wanted them to be represented by a picture. And regardless of how liberal I think I am and how open-minded I am, it doesn't matter how much good intentions I have, I grew up in Israel for 36 years under certain stereotypes. So if I want it or not, there's something planted, or at least might be planted somewhere in my back conscious, that I would want to portray them in a way that I think about them. And that's not necessarily how they think about themselves. So I had to explain to them and make decisions together with them. They chose where they would be photographed. I would just have to make sure that it makes sense as a picture so you guys can at least visually enjoy it a little bit. But they decide also what they wear. Like this guy, they're like, you know, I'm a football player. I have to wear a Real Madrid shirt. Nothing here was changed. We didn't, you know, put things on the walls intentionally. This guy, for example, just finished redecorating his room or painted it in pink because that's his favorite color, apparently, and put the Palestinian flag and DiCaprio on the wall. For those of you that know what semiotic is, I was really interested in semiotics and what the signifiers are here. What do we have on the wall? How do they actually tell the story about the people? I used the language of environmental portraiture because the environment will tell as much as a story about the person as the person himself. This guy was one of the last people photographed, Bara. And I was actually introduced to him by a different family that was also photographed. The reason I was introduced, because it's a very hard story and you have to be introduced to photograph somebody like that. Any idea what are the paintings on the walls?
Mortars.
Not mortars, his brother. His brother used to be a peace activist. And at the age of 17, he went to watch to a demonstration. There were demonstrations, kind of clashes between the Arab people of Israel, citizens of Israel, and the Israeli police in year 2000. It was the year of the Second Intifada, and they wanted to show their support. The result was that bullets were fired into the crowd at some points, and 13 people were killed, including his brother, turning the whole family from peace activists to anti-Israel activists. The guy is brilliant, super brilliant. If I'm going to put him at MSU, he's going to be one of the top students here for sure. GMAT of 780. Brilliant. So I asked to photograph him, and he allowed it. And when I asked, you know, why did you allow me to photograph you? He said, like, you're the first person that asked about me and not about my brother. The second thing was, you know, after the whole interview, it was a very politically loaded interview. He wanted to talk politics. This was, you know, how he defined himself. And then I'm asking him, Bara, how come you allowed a Jewish person to come into your house, ask you your questions, and to photograph you? He said, like, try to forget that you're a Jew. I try to focus on the person. And even though you know everything that happened and everything that your country did to me, you're asking the questions you want to know, you really want to know, I'll tell you. Just represent my word, you know, as I said it, as uncomfortable to you as it is, this is your obligation to me. I let you into my house, you have to respect that. You don't have it in the exhibition, but if you go on my website, you will see what he said. And for me, it was very encouraging, even if in this situation, after everything that happened, he still allows a guy into this. The first guy that photographs him is his enemy. Now, you have to understand that this, I want to create here a body of work of some how one person photographs their enemy, or at least their adversary. Not all of them think of me as an enemy. We say in Hebrew, kabdeu vehashdeu. How do you say it in Arabic? I don't know. I don't know if you know what it means. It means respect him and suspect him. So, as a guest in the house, I would be respected, but nobody would really believe my intentions, including the closest people that I worked with. In order to photograph 64 people, I had to build a network of 80 people to help me. Three of them, the main ones, one Muslim, one Druze, one Bedouin. In the middle of the project, the Muslim left because he said, like, I don't know if you know so much about these people. Maybe you're going to hurt them. If you are part of the Mossad, the Israeli Secret Service, you can ruin their lives. I don't want to be part of this. This is the guy that worked closest to me. All right? So if you're working with this kind of distrust, it's pretty interesting how you put yourself in the same situation of trying to get into the houses of people that hate you on an institutional level, very fundamental level, and trying to photograph them in a way that is respectful. Not only respectful, kind of creates interest. This is the last person photographed in the project. Her name is Dina. She was born to a Jewish Ukrainian mother and an Arab Muslim Israeli father in Ukraine. At the age of 5, the family moved to Israel and lived in an Arab city. And when she was 18, she left her parents' house and moved to Tel Aviv, Jaffa, which is mixed between Arabs and Jews, and became a civil rights activist. So she holds both passports, the Ukrainian and the Israeli one. Because of Judaism, she's considered because of her mother, she's considered in Judaism as Jewish. Because of the father, she's considered in Islam as Muslim. So when I came to ask her, how do you define yourself? She said, you know, I can correct to anything that you want me to be, whatever makes you comfortable. But if you really ask me, I'm a human rights activist. Now, question. How do you define yourself? You, her, you. All right, good beginning. Any idea, sir?
I'm biracial American.
Biracial American, okay. All right, animal lover, biracial, forgot what you said, human being. All right. Let me show you three guys here. Each one I asked, the last question in the interview was, how do you define yourself? I want to show you what three people said. Oh, it's not the right one, sorry. Oh, it is the right one. Sorry.
Arabia Palestinaid Chaya be Eret Israel. Arin Hazala, Betach. אמרתי לך, מהתחלה. כלום, בסדר.
למה דווקא ככה?
למה? כי אני ככה, זה המציאות, זה מה שיש. השורשים שלי, אני פלסטינאית, השורשים. ואני ערבייה, שזה גם בשורשים. וחיה בארץ ישראל.
פלסטינית, שחיה במדינת ישראל. זאת ההגדרה שלי.
לא
כישראלית. יכול להיות, לפעמים, כאילו, אני זוכרת שההגדרה האחרונה שלי הייתה ערבייה ישראלית, אבל כאילו ישראלית, כאילו, אני יכולה לקחת את ישראל בתור מדינה שאני חיה בה. וגם, האמת שגם אני יכולה לקחת את זה גם ערבייה, חצי ישראלית וחצי פלסטינית.
זהו, אני בארץ של ישראל, במדינת ישראל, זה אני ערבי-ישראלי. אני, אין הבדל ביני לבין היהודי. כולנו יחד, כולנו הולכים על תנאי אחד. איך שמבקשים ממנו במדינה הזאת וכל הזה, הולכים על אותו דרך. באמת, אני לא מרגיש שאני ערבי פלסטיני או ערבי זהו, אני מרגיש את עצמי ערבי ישראלי זה. ככה אני חושב. אני לא הולך על פני שזהו, אני ערבי פלסטיני. וזהו. אני לא מהראש הזה, מהדברים. אני ערבי ישראלי, זה. כמוני, כמו כל אחד בישראל, כמו כל בן אדם חי בישראל.
It's kind of an identity crisis. you're an Arab person living in Israel. 20 years ago, their parents would never even mention they're Palestinians. It would get them into a lot of trouble. These young kids call themselves the generation that stands up straight, that is proud of their Palestinian origin, wearing the flag on all kinds of clothes. I think if you would hang the flag in the 1990s in Israel, that would be a criminal act, literally a criminal act. So things change a little bit. And still people are trying to figure out, you know, how they belong. Now, here in America, you know, people may be defining themselves not by their religion, political views, or stuff like that, but more about, you know, if I'm an animal lover, what am I studying? If I'm a human being, you know, different, totally different set of definitions. But this is part of their world, and she was one of only two people throughout the project that used her profession to define herself, a human rights activist. She had a lot of options. The other guy had no options, and this is what happened. He's a Druze living in the Golan Heights. What happened with the Druze in that section, the Golan Heights were conquered, Israel conquered that area in 1973 from Syria. The Druze in that area refused to get Israeli citizenship. So now those people there don't have a citizenship at all, not a Syrian one, nor an Israeli one. He hates the Druze religion. He doesn't believe in religion at all, so he would never define himself that way. He wants to leave his village and just be, you know, on his own. So that option goes out the window as well. So he was kind of like really struggling. He's like, would it help you to say I'm a musician? So this is Israel a little bit. Now, you will notice that all of these portraits are taken in very intimate locations and very intimate perspectives, but the body language is never inviting. And this is kind of to testify about the nature of our engagement. This was photographed about an hour after we really met for the first time. At that point, you know, they're still kind of questioning me who I am and why am I doing what I'm doing. It cannot be a happy situation. You know, if any of you guys would photograph it, we would get a very definitely result in a very profound way. And at the beginning, I was kind of questioning, this is how I want to portray them. But then I reached the conclusion of, yes, this is part of why we're photographing this. Because I want you guys to think, you know, I'm photographing here the other side, trying to do something that will be compassionate, will create respect, because I believe that respect is the beginning of any dialogue. If you don't respect the other side, you're not going to talk to him. So I try to create here respect and a little bit humanizing the whole situation. No more people with guns or explosives. Ihab. Meet Ihab. Get into his bedroom. You guys can do the same thing in your own communities, in your own adversaries or enemies or whoever is on the other side. The idea is to create a formula that really confuses your viewer. This is not a visual narrative that you ever saw about Israel. Good. Now, I don't know what you're going to think, but at least you are going to think, right? Going back to the beginning of my lecture, I don't want to tell you what to think. I don't know what is right. Maybe the guy they're saying that this is what happens to Arabs, people in Israel, is right. His perception, I cannot defy that. This is a platform for thinking, a different platform for thinking. Asil, the girl I was waiting for when I photographed the picture of the mosque, and then she comes and talks about how Islam is misrepresented and how, you know, she would love, there's so many things beautiful in Islam. Eventually, we photograph her in her room next to her guitar and makeup and everything. Some people I went back to. She comes from a family of educators. Her father is managing a school. Her mother used to be a teacher. Her favorite TV shows are The Imam Speaking. MTV is totally out of the question. This was the first time I met her after she graduated from school. 4 months later, she was engaged to be married. And again, the language of environmental portraiture and how it really creates a story around the person. Some of these are already exhibited that are part of the exhibition, so I really want to invite you guys to go there. We said that the picture is worth 1,000 words, but in this case, presenting the pictures by themselves would really be disrespectful for the people I photographed and kind of ask you guys again to apply some stereotypes. Because the people that you see here, you never know, like, where is she from? Like, she could really be from Detroit. Maybe weird house decorations, but that might make sense. She's a Bedouin, coming from an African descent, from Sudan. Now, the thing is that we have discrimination or racism in Israel quite a bit, especially towards black people. So within her own sect, because she's black, she's considered to have less honor. The family has less honor, which is normally a bad thing to do. But on the other hand, if you have less honor, you have less honor to protect. So you're more flexible in terms of how you can live your life. She doesn't have to wear a hijab or the dress, but rather pants and a hat. She can go live, study medicine in in Russia, this is her dream, as opposed to people from her own sect, which have to learn in an institution close to their house because they have to be back every night. There's no such thing as a Bedouin woman staying in the dorms because there are going to be rumors. Maybe she's going to meet men. And if she meets men and actually has something, their family has to kill her. Honor of the family. More important than anything. So these guys are up there. You know, go read their testimonies next to the pictures. An excerpt of like 3-4 paragraphs that give you a little bit of indication who these people are and why they photograph. This one, by the way, is also Bedouin, living about 15 minutes away from the other one. But she already has honor to defend. So in order to photograph her, I don't ask her. Ask her father. So we meet, we have dinner and lunch together and explain to him the project, and he loves it. And he said, like, sure, my daughter will be photographed. Calls her in and tell her, you're going to be photographed. I'm like, excuse me, sir, you know, but with all due respect, I really have to ask for her permission, because if she's not involved, this is not going to work. So I ask for his permission to ask for her permission, and he gives me permission. So I ask for her permission, and she says, I cannot give you permission. I have to ask my father. So she asks for his permission to give me permission. And eventually she gives me her permission. So we have permission, right? So after that, what would you expect? I would expect a subdued woman, Muslim woman, you know, Muslim, to say everything the right way, very politely, very subdued, right? No. Out comes this feminist woman saying the roles of women in the society has to change. I do not want to belong to my father. They really belong as property. I do not want to belong to my father nor to my husband when I get married. I want to study. I want to be a documentary filmmaker. I want to make a film about my village. Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta. Her father said, like, you know, shut it. So they're like, no, you gave me a permission. Now I can speak. And she goes. Then she takes me to this room, says, like, you want me to represent it? This is how I represent it. This is the computer. This is my future. This is God. It's written above, El Allah bil Allah. There is nobody but God. This is where I come from, and this is where I'm going. And this is where you photograph me. Photograph for a few pictures, like, you're done. Tough cookie. This guy is Jihad. It's one of the only guys that we actually met on the street. Didn't plan to meet with him. A guy canceled on me, so I took my interpreter and said, like, we're going to the hardest part of town. He said, like, you are totally nuts. It's drugs infected. So, like, yeah, let's see what we can get. So we stopped by Jihad and two of his cousins, and I'm like, hey, I'm Nathan. I'm an Israeli artist. I want to photograph you. First, I asked if he's 18. He said, like, yeah. So, like, I want to photograph you. So, like, really? So they were so shocked about the guy. First of all, anybody going to that part of town. Then a Jewish person going to that part of town. And then a Jewish person going to that part of town wanting to photograph him totally took him out of his comfort zone. So they brought us into their house and made us the main guests. Really talked about all his life, which was fascinating, how he has a girlfriend, but her father doesn't let him meet her because he was in jail, how he tries to get out of this world, but he can't because it's a circle of violence. Anytime that some of his friends or his gang would come into the room, then total bravado, yeah, you know, I'm the leader. And then, okay, now I'm Jihad. All those portraits were about representation, about identity, about the nature of our engagement. So they do humanize this whole story, but I wanted to create even to go the extra mile. I stayed with them another few hours and really trying to photograph, you know, their lives, creating a total different visual narrative than anything that you would be used to until now. This is a Bedouin house. There's no furniture. You sit on the steps. The girl belongs to her father at this point. Man. Remember the girl that was engaged to be married? So this was the first visit. After everything, suddenly I found myself photograph her putting makeup, a Muslim woman putting makeup in her bedroom, guys. For me, it's one of the most important pictures in the project. If I could get this close, so can others. It's just a decision and a commitment. So, again, some of this picture, I'm going to move a little bit faster so I can first. Sit down for a second. Sit down. Trust me, a second. This is maklube, very tasty. I don't know. One picture that I want to go. This is a bar, by the way, for 20,000 people. Only 3% of the kids finish high school in this city. We're back to Aram. After photographing her portrait, her sister comes in. She makes her homework. And then the sister leaves. So I'm alone with a Muslim woman in the house. It's a very uncomfortable situation in terms of rumors. So she goes to the door, and I'm sure she's going to open it wide so everybody can see nothing is happening. Instead, she just closes it. And she comes to me and she says, have you ever been in love? Obviously a weird question. I'm like, yeah, why are you asking? How does it feel? Like, it feels good. Why are you asking them, Ram? He says, like, well, I'm engaged to be married. For the first time in my life, I'm allowed to love. And I don't know how I feel. You're the only man I can talk to because you're Jewish. I can never talk about this with any Muslim pen. We start talking about love in Hebrew, Arabic, English, salad of languages. Then we talk about God, and I told her that I don't believe in God. She's like, how do you don't believe in God? We Muslims have our God, you Jews have your God. So we start talking about religion. And at one point I asked her, Anram, would you ever believe that you're going to sit on your bed with a Jewish man, double your age, talking about God and love? I said, no. What do you think if we tell it about it to other people? She's like, nobody's going to believe us. I said, like, well, I have to tell it to everybody because this is the essence of our project. Now you can go. I can go back and show you a little bit of the other, or we can already take questions. What do you think? Let's take some questions.
You've made some comments about Muslim women, and it sounded like you thought they would be, you know, quiet and submissive, but you also said other things about the honor of the family, and where is that information from? Is that from what you learned from the women themselves, or from the guys who took you around, or something you read?
All of the above. One of the biggest mistakes that one can do when doing this thing is thinking that you know. Like, I lived in Israel for 36 years, I could definitely say, yeah, I've seen these guys, I know what they're all about. But I really try to understand that I really don't understand anything. So I started off with a research stage of about a couple of months, talking to thinkers, reporters, reading books, trying to gather as much information I can about the society, especially things that will be challenging and I didn't know before. And after that, as you go along, you still continue learning things, you can still continue asking questions, again, to really be able to tell the story properly. So it's my personal understanding. Some of it might be a little bit misguided, you know, because we're living a life and some person can tell you the wrong thing, but to the best of my ability, telling you something that I believe in or I think is true. Yeah. In Israel, it's actually a phenomenon, especially with the Bedouins. There's a girl, for example, in the project, you can see on the walls there, she's not Bedouin, she's Druze. And she made the mistake of falling in love with a guy. Not only that she'd fallen in love with a guy, the problem is that she comes from a family of five sisters and a mother, the parents divorced, and there's no brothers. Now, the reason is that there is no male figure in the family, and the male figures are the ones to hold the honor, or to protect the honor. They're kind of in charge of the women. When there's no man involved, everybody's really afraid of what the women would do, theoretically. So the family had to take extra precautions so there's not going to be any rumors that would offend the family. Now, she actually fell in love. They broke up because the guy was kind of interesting. After that, she was introduced to an older man from better means, and they were actually kind of almost engaged to be married. When the guy heard that, like the ex-boyfriend, he came back and, you know, showed the love, and again, young love, so she went back to the old guy, which totally made the whole family crazy. Now, the situation was that on her diary, the cover, there was writing, I will only be killed by the hands of my lover. Why? Because at that point, she was already, her and her lover had death threats against them. If they don't separate, they were going to be killed. 3 months later, I revisited her, totally in depression, they had to separate so she can save his life. She separated from him, not for her, for him. There's occasional stories, fewer and fewer, especially in the Bedouin society. If there's even a rumor against the daughter that something happened and you fear that you're losing the honor of the family, you kill your daughter and you go to the police and say, I just killed my daughter. And you serve the time. This is the honorable thing to do. And it's super frustrating. It's something that I hope will disappear from this world. It hasn't disappeared yet. In Israel itself, the Bedouin society is so closed that even the police doesn't handle, like they deal with the leaders of the society. They let them sort their own problems within themselves out of respect and understanding that otherwise, you know, the clan system is so different than anything we have there. We can understand it. When murder happens, we intervene. In most cases, again, the brother or the father that killed the problematic person, they would come to the police and say that I just killed that, you know, do it because this is honorable to do. I don't know, I don't believe a lot in honor myself. I believe in human beings, but when you are photographing somebody else, you try to really step into their shoes and try to understand it. This is where it comes from. We stopped having female mutilation in Israel, though. at least as much as I know, which I'm really happy about. We also had that problem. Yes?
That we read that Arab Israelis are in the professions, they're in politics. You said that 3% of the students actually graduate.
At that specific city called Kalkir? Yeah, in that specific city, Jajulia, 3% of the people graduate from high school. It's lower percentages than the Jews, significantly. I'm not sure exactly the exact percentage, but I would be surprised if it's more than 50%. 50. 30 would be a much better estimate, if we're talking about the whole country.
Well, the people you photograph look, yeah, the body language, they look, you know, sort of defensive and sometimes reactive. Do they have a sense that they can aspire?
Some yes, some no. Some of them jihad, the gang leader, he has no aspirations. Like, he has aspirations for tomorrow. Muhammad, the first one that we saw, we didn't really go into his story. He threw stones at Israeli police. He dropped out of school 2 years before graduation. He was in jail for a month, and he was wearing a bracelet around his ankle, monitoring his movements. So no aspirations. But the girl, for example, that was saying, unfortunately, at the end, oh, yeah, that girl has aspirations. She's not going to stop before a PhD. So different people come from different walks of life. It's harder as an Arab person in Israel, the same way that being an African-American here 50 years ago was harder. It's very similar in a lot of ways. Yeah. There's also lack of resources. There's corruptions within the own local municipalities. So it's pretty... like when I asked Bara, the guy that his brother was killed, what is his dream? He said, I want to build a youth center in the city, you know, to let young people actually have a future, because the money doesn't go the right places. I know how to study. I know how to play the music. You know, I'll be okay. But all of my friends, I have no hopes from them. Right? So sometimes the inspiration goes within the society itself. So it's ghettoizing your own thing. You know, so it's some kind of a snowball that you have to stop. Yeah. Oh, I thought you had a question. Others? Yes, sir.
Since not a lot of people asked a question, I'll ask you.
Sure. If you can afterwards bring the mic to the gentleman behind you, just because I think he might want to ask a question as well. Yeah.
Yes. Sure. Well, I have many questions. I know, thank you. It's a stunning photography. One of the questions that came to my mind as I'm looking at them is, you know, as you're looking at your, you know, the subject, who's your primary audience? Who are you trying to connect with, or, you know, reach through your photography? And, you know, like, so that's one part. Actually, I have many, but the other one, you compare what you do to the pictures that we see by Google,
yeah.
You know, and I wonder, you know, like, how do you see your pictures actually, you know, helping as opposed to the others not helping? You know, like, one of the issues that also we need to consider whether or not, you know, like, there's intense violence in the system. And, you know, like, colonialism itself can be, you know, seen as an extremely violent event, and those, the violent events are reflected in what we mostly dominate, what we see. So, you know, like, the later.
That's the thing. The idea is any kind of change starts from a different way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And a different way of thinking starts from having a platform or something to steer that different way of thinking. So the idea was not to use the same imagery that we already know and emphasize the same stereotypes and the same storylines and therefore not effective in creating any change. It was using any kind of other imagery that will confuse people. And when you're confused or anybody else is confused, you have to think about it, to sort it out at least for yourself, to make sense. And if it's actually a little bit interesting, maybe you're also afterwards going to research it a little bit.
Yes, sir.
Research it a little bit. Mm-hmm. Look into it, you know, learn a little bit about it as well, or at least have a critical mind about it, understanding that not necessarily everybody in Israel is throwing stones or suffering. A lot of other people are actually doing some other things, like these guys a lot of people also in the West Bank and Gaza, most of the people, both Jews and Palestinians, hate war, would love just to go to school, go to the grocery shop, and have a vacation every once in a while. We're all human, but there's a little bit of more complex society. The idea here is to make a platform that if I'm an Israeli person, I look at this, and this is the hub. It's not a Palestinian. It's the guy in the room. It's the person that, you know, maybe he's from MSU, maybe he's in Long Island, maybe he's in Tel Aviv. We start getting confused. And when that confusion happens, and also suddenly it's like, he can be me, when that things happen, suddenly, hopefully, there's a little bit more respect to the other side, or at least more interest to the other side. And this is when dialogue starts. So I try to kind of translate my own personal interest and my own personal experience to something that other people can at least start. But this is just, you know, the first step. It's a long journey. So again, saying that I'm going to change the world is a little bit presumptuous, but I can help. Well, at least this is what I thought. And this is also what I'm saying here for everybody. You know, this is just one example. Taiwan and China, Pakistan, India, not the two conflicts, but this is big, right? Why not talk about different parts of Detroit, all right, different parts of Michigan? How do you portray the other side? How do you make sense of all of this? Because hatred or problems happen everywhere. In terms of an audience, pretty wide audience, especially people that are not convinced or people that you want to confuse. And the kids around this, the 50,000 students here, main audience, people that actually will make a change.
And because I don't want to monopolize.
No, no, no.
Just simply, I do not doubt your sincerity. And, you know, one of the things that you're trying to do is to humanize, you know, like the group inside Israel that has been forgotten, not considered as full citizens, as you yourself have pointed out. But so when I ask about the audience, you know, like for the Palestinians, they already, you know, like they understand their humanity.
You would be surprised. Like, one of the reasons that most of the people did it, so people in Arab countries will see them.
Well,
they're brothers.
Mm-hmm. I think there are maybe some misconception on the, but the audience would be, I think, the primary of seeing the humanity, would be the Jewish Israeli public.
That would be the primary.
And,
yes.
And whether or not, you know, like the idea, you know, maybe a mixture of the two could be good, because there is also, isn't there a risk of actually, instead of seeing it, you know, like ending depoliticizing, you know, like the issue.
There is no chance of doing that.
Yeah,
the issue is so politicized, there is not a chance on earth. If you're 5 years old in Israel, you have a political view.
Mm-hmm.
This is how it runs deep. There is no chance on earth to depoliticize it. That is the problem. Yes, it actually was hopefully the main audience. Unfortunately, it didn't really work that way. This exhibition traveled, or part of it traveled all around the world. It was in Croatia, in Bratislava, in various places in the U.S., in South Africa, South America. It was only twice in Israel, as four portraits in two different group shows. It was never published in Israel. Really sorry about that.
Well, this is more questions.
But just to say that, it's really saddens me. Yeah.
Sorry. In September, Maddie Friedman published a long essay, which is all over the web, documenting in extreme detail how the Associated Press constantly killed stories that did not conform to their accepted narrative.
Yeah.
My question, therefore, is this. I can sit here and say, Google Israel News English, and get a bunch of hits. But what can I reliably believe? What represents a fair and balanced assessment of the present situation?
In terms of the media? New York Times is doing a pretty good job, relatively good job. There's limitations as well there. There was an accusation against one of the photographers that just the life on the ground for photographers there or anybody working within Gaza was pretty problematic because the Palestinians themselves didn't allow them to cover different things. If they would actually photograph or report on different things happening, which happened in front of their eyes, they would be killed. literally killed. There were death threats around them, and they actually reported this back. Now, we're talking about Pulitzer Prize winners that couldn't photograph things that happened, like missiles being fired out of schools. Things were done, obviously, I have to say, if I'm a Palestinian, I would do the same thing. I'm trying to say myself that the battlefield is not even. I would play dirty. But the thing was that how to govern the public opinion was a thing that was very much aware of and posed a lot of different things. I don't know who to trust. You know, I don't think that any kind of news media outlet can represent the story for all its complexity. You will always hear a subset of it. Putting in efforts, Time magazine, New York Times, some German magazines definitely, like Der Spiegel and Stern magazine, to tell you that they're as successful, no, because sometimes there's limitation. And this doesn't happen only in Palestine, you know, or Israel, depending on how you want to call it. If I now go to Syria, the reporting there is very, very partial, because again, as a reporter on the ground, your life depends in the life of the people that help you. If you are doing something to offend them, and they can read it online now, in the past it would be in a magazine, it would be published after you're already outside, so you could do whatever you want. Now, on that day, everybody sees that. If they see that you did something they don't like, you might have a death threat about it. Because the life of journalism or journalist has been really devaluated during the last few years, since 2011, basically. To execute a journalist right now sounds like the real good thing to do. Right? Just see what happened the last few months. Or blocking journalism, what happened in Iran or Syria, of trying to lock down internet and mid journalism. So when this becomes the state of mind and awareness of we have to block this, it makes life of journalists and the ability to report everything honestly much, much harder. So at least as an honest journalist, you will not report. You will not report something different. You will just not report. And thank God, at least this is what we're required. Some cases, some journalists, and it happens on all sides, might create a reality a little bit, which is even worse, intensify things that they would want to happen. Now, there would be a joke running between both Israeli and Palestinian photographers in Israel, Jewish people or Arabs. If you would have a bombing in Israel, a Jewish area, as a photographer, you would run to the scene. The scene would be blocked by the police. The medics would go in, would clear the bodies and try to save the injured people. And after they finished, the journalists can go in and photograph whatever is left. Palestinian, there's a bombing, you run to the scene. The scene is blocked until the photographers finish photographing, and then the medics go and rescue whoever can be rescued. It's not really a joke. This is exactly how it happened in a lot of cases, which is kind of uncomfortable. The awareness of how to play on the media front is very different. Israel is constantly losing on that front because we don't play the game the way that, you know, to that intensity of the other side. We just don't. And, you know, not everybody can. I'm not saying that Israel is right or wrong. I'm saying they just play a different, the Jewish part playing a different game. And I don't know which one is effective. Mostly, you know, I can see that the Israeli side is not represented or the ideas are not really understood. Which media you can believe? Be hesitant. Try to think all the time, you know. If something resonates with you, if you feel that somebody explained something in an intelligent way, maybe you want to accept that. Otherwise, there's narratives all across the board. We're people, you know, we represent something according to how we understand that. If there's not a system to filter that and try to really validate that, New York Times are doing a really good job, I can tell you that. Yeah. Other questions? Nada. I'll leave you with something happy before you leave, all right? Because we have maybe a little bit more time left. Where is it? So, coming soon. Coming Soon is my last series, which was right now exhibited in Russia, what Howard mentioned. It's the first series I photographed in New York. So I moved to New York in 2008, and it's a funny thing that happens. You know, when you go to New York as a tourist, you can't stop photographing. Everything is interesting, right? You move there, and then everything is boring. You cannot photograph anything. Nothing has meaning anymore. Especially when you move, like you can see that it's important for me to really understand what I'm photographing. And the first thing I understood when I moved to the U.S. is that I don't understand you guys. Americans are crazy. So, still, I was in grad school. I had to bring some pictures to class, so I took my camera. I went to Fifth Avenue, the symbol of the American dream for us Israelis. You know, it's where you can do shopping. And I came across this billboard. I photographed this. Now, when I first came to New York in 1997, I remember that, you know, everybody told me it's like Tel Aviv, just bigger. And I came out, like, I lived in Brooklyn, and I came out of the subway first time in Rockefeller Center. I got out of the subway, and literally, like, whoa. I spent a few minutes kind of recovering from that. And I remember everything being gigantic, beautiful, huge avenues, big buildings. But the thing was, every time I would look up, there would be huge billboards. There would be so much advertising. I never saw so much advertising in my life. That was the main thing I remembered from New York. And here I was, suddenly the billboards moved to the ground level and covered the whole facade of the building. So kind of made a nice picture. I was happy, went up another few blocks, and ta-da. So I photographed this as well. Then I showed it to my class, and everybody liked these pictures, and I liked these pictures, but I said to myself, yeah, this is not a project, you know, there's only a couple of those I came across, I was lucky. And regardless, it's not my photography, right? And I'm much more intimate, I'm doing different stuff. This is not real photography for me, right? So, but again, the same as belief, your projects find you. So 3 years later, I'm looking around my archive, and I'm like, I have a lot of those billboards. What am I doing? Why am I photographing this? So I started photographing this in a more conscious way. And really trying to explore the urban landscape, the commercial urban landscape around the city centers of New York, and how everything is morphing. In the 70s, we would have, in the 40s, we would have architecture, amazing architecture. 70s, a lot of graffiti. 90s, a lot of street scenes. Now, commercialism. So I started working on this every once in a while, finding a billboard, spending an hour, a day, a few, photographing this and really trying to see the relationship between this, I don't know, virtual dream that is created in the billboard and the reality that is under it. And therefore, well, serendipity here was my friend and my enemy. Sometimes I had to wait a few days, like in this case, I think I went back 3 or 4 times. But once this happens, serendipity is your best friend. So yeah, the guy, it was before Christmas, this was a present for somebody, I'm guessing. So I was really wondering, what can work with this tiger, leopard, I don't know how you call it, like, yeah, what can work with this? I was waiting for a Russian, again, stereotypes, Russian woman with a fur coat to walk under it with her little dog. And suddenly this guy comes along, so... I was really kind of looking on how we regard these people. You know, this is a much more, again, like different artistic languages supporting different themes. In this case, I had to have a much more flat perspective and much more removed because respecting also how I regard this. I'm an outsider, still an outsider a little bit. Even though they're not, you don't look as crazy. Some things make sense. A lot of specific moments. I was thinking how these mammoth figures are both kind of trying to create our society by selling us things, but they also represent it in the same time. And years ago, many years ago, we also had things that represented our societies and created them in the same time. We used to call them statues in the days of the Romans and the Greeks. But those statues still exist, right? And those things, 3, 4 weeks, a couple of months, poof. It's in a way kind of how we're dealing with information right now. You guys, you know, most of the stuff that you were handling would be for weeks, months, right? Most of the young guys in the back, you know, they're going to read something on their iPhone, and then the next hour, if they remember it, it's totally gone. If they think of something for a week, it's important. If they think of something for a month, it's going to stay with them the rest of their lives. How we process information, how we deal with, you know, our new gods is very different. These are our new gods, our new things to aspire to. Yeah, five days until suddenly there was no cars and it was cold and... That actually was on a Sunday, so it's a long weekend, so here you go. Yeah. Reality, it was kind of interesting how reality keeps surprising, and you would find the situation, nothing here is staged, nothing here is Photoshop. This is everything, one shot. Stand there and just wait for the moment to happen. So patience was an interesting thing. I was also thinking of how effective those billboards really are. If you think about it, there's no other medium that... you can shut off. This is the only media that you cannot turn off. TV, change the channel. Radio, lower the volume. Magazine, flip the page. You have to get to where you need to get on the street, right? You have to pass through the space. So when I was showing this to Americans, most Americans did not know the billboards. Most foreigners actually saw them every once in a while. I think that if you cannot shut the space, you kind of shut yourself. There's only 2 pictures where people are looking at the billboards, and I think they were looking because they saw that somebody was photographing, so what the hell? Yeah. One of those pictures during the 3 years that just came about. So this is a little bit lighter subject in a larger sense, but you know, it still deals with our consumer world about thinking about where it is going to, how are we developing, how are we acting as a society, why is this accepted as, you know, our visualization. Why don't we have a Van Gogh painting on this bus? All right? You know, why don't we have an interesting diagram that you guys study about, an invitation to an exhibition at the Met? Instead, we have this. Now, this, for example, was a very hard... Every billboard has a life of its own. And I never know what is going to be the situation that will actually resonate with it. In this case, I was photographing it, and I was not happy, and suddenly this guy comes and just stares at me, and I photograph, and I feel something powerful just happened. So I look back at the pictures when I'm editing them at home, and I'm like, holy, there's no black people in the pictures, in the ads. Almost no. I kind of managed to find a couple. Maybe sometimes it's about the madness of how we sell water by crazy shirts of babies. Or well, sometimes, again, the gods of photography are nice to you and all you have to do is shoot. So I don't know how this guy found himself placing his hot dog stand there, but thank you. Any idea what this is advertising? Real estate property. Now, what is better to advertise a real estate property rather than a sexy woman and a strong man? Right? You Americans are nuts. Anyway, this is what we're dealing with. This is kind of the messages that are, again, stereotypes being sent to us. So this was one of the hardest ones to photograph, but suddenly those girls were there, and I was like, okay, cause and effect, and that woman passes, and like... When I photographed this one, I was kind of like, I wasn't sure that I was, I didn't want to photograph a lot of homeless people. It was kind of, it was an easy trap to fall into. This is not the essence of the project, even though they are homeless people. But at this point, it was like, I have to photograph this. And I was a little bit frustrated about not knowing if people actually notice her or not. And then somebody actually told me something that I really liked. He said, like, we notice her, but then we don't want to notice her, so we look at everything else. But the eye keeps going there, kind of in the same way of how we live our lives. So, interesting. At this point, if you're wondering where's the billboard, good. Maybe I resonate a little bit with you, because this is how it usually is. That's it. Thank you very much for coming, guys. Really appreciate it.